from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's not a fun time to be a public employee. All across the state, public employees, their unions, and their pension benefits are the subject of tough talk and pointed politics. This week, four state public employee unions agreed to double their contributions to their pension funds following negotiations with the governor's office. While here in the Bay Area, city administrators and public employee unions in both San Jose and San Francisco remain at odds. In the hour ahead, we'll take a look at what's going on with state public employee unions, why they're the focus of so much scrutiny right now, and what their future might look like. The state of public employees, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Today is the last official Furlough Friday, those unpaid days off for state employees that Governor Schwarzenegger ordered a year ago. But that doesn't mean the future necessarily looks bright for public employees. Furloughs could return, and there's a great deal of pressure on public employee unions these days to reduce either pay or pension benefits or both. Earlier this week, four public employee unions representing 23,000 state workers agreed to having members double their pension contributions, and two of the unions agreed to push back the age their employees could retire with full benefits from age 50 to 55. In return, the unions received a guarantee that workers will be paid even if there's a state budget impasse. Those agreements still have to be ratified by union membership and signed by the governor. The same story is playing out in cities across the state. Last night, the San Jose City Council approved a budget which includes a 10% pay cut for 1,600 city workers. So what's going on these days with public employees and their unions? Why are they so much in the crosshairs of public scrutiny and political debate? To get a sense of what's going on, we're joined first by John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED News. John, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Let's talk first about the deal that happened this week in Sacramento, well, tentative deal, I guess we should say, until it's ratified. Is it a sign of the times?
I think it is in a number of ways. I mean, you know, a couple of things there that are caveats to this deal. First of all, it only affects about 23,000 state workers. That's fewer than 1 in 10 of the state workforce, or actually it's about 1 in 10 of the state workforce. It's fewer than that, though, of a greater span. So it's really not a tremendous number of employees yet. And the question, I think, is that a template for what happens with other unions when the governor and the Schwarzenegger administration try to negotiate with them? But I think it's a bit of a sign of the times. I mean, the state clearly doesn't have any money. And so there's a great motivation there. I think state workers, you talk to a lot of them, they are very frustrated after this long, long furlough process that, as you just said, is about to end, we believe, at the end of the fiscal year here. And so I think that there was a willingness for concessions that might not have been there in the past. The question is this really quote-unquote pension reform that the governor negotiated in these deals? I mean, you know, what I think is key to understand about what happened is that the current employees that exist under these deals, the only thing they agreed to, the biggest thing they agreed to, I probably should say, is that they are going to increase the contribution toward their retirement to about 10% of what they make. All these other things about that you have to work longer to receive full benefits, a lot of these things about spiking of pensions, a lot of that is going to apply to new employees, people who have not yet come on the job. And so there's going to be a differentiation between people that exist now and people that exist later. And, I think it's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how this happens. And as you said, they haven't been ratified yet, either by the legislature or by a full union vote. That could be contentious.
And what does it indicate, if anything, about the overall clout of public employee unions, which have been a powerful force at the state capitol for a number of decades now? Do you see a sort of tipping point in that case, too?
Well, you know, I think if you back up and you think about it a little bit, I mean, one of the challenges, especially when, and we're looking, you know, kind of specifically, I would look at the state of California, is when the state doesn't have any money and everybody starts fighting over a very limited number of dollars that are in the budget, everybody starts to make accusations and point fingers about who's getting the raw deal and who's getting what. And, You know, and state workers do work across the entire breadth of the state government. So, you know, you've got a lot of folks in different agencies who, you know, get labeled as bureaucrats and, you know, are they, you know, really doing their jobs? And, so you get a lot more of that kind of dynamic. But at the same time, as you alluded to, you have several unions and really one in particular, SEIU, which represents a lot of the state workforce that play politics very hard. And as a result, when you play politics very hard, people are going to kind of fire back at you. Some of the unions, you know, that represent some of these workers are really not political forces. They're kind of very quiet and under the radar, but some are. And I think, you know, the combination of being very political plus not having a lot of money. And again, these stories from especially around the state and local governments of some of these really excessive pension deals, they really are all kind of a fuel this desire to do something different. And while I say that it sounds like it's hype, it is not all hype. I mean, the state is facing a tremendous pension liability in the out years. There's a debate about what exactly that number is. But we're talking a lot of money that the state has currently no plan how to pay for in the future.
In fact, the last study I saw out of Stanford put that unfunded liability at $500 billion. So
yeah, there's a little bit of debate about whether those numbers are right. It depends on who you talk to. I'm sure some of your guests will talk about that study in particular. But I do think everyone agrees there is a tremendous unfunded liability to the state.
Last quick question, John, and that sort of set the stage for us politically over these next 5 months leading up to the gubernatorial election. The Republican candidate, Meg Whitman, has already made a point of sort of pointing at a public employee union, saying the next governor has got to have a spine of steel. And Jerry Brown, of course, the Democratic nominee, has had a long history of support from those public employee unions. Do you see this as being something that will be central to how that gubernatorial campaign plays out?
I do, though I do wonder with this announcement of these deals on pension concessions and, you know, especially if that takes to other unions that represent state workers, will that somewhat negate one of the points that the Whitman campaign wants to make about the need out there? And this may kind of pit the current Republican governor against the would-be Republican governor as to what exactly is pension reform. But I do think it's going to be out there. The labor unions are supporting Jerry Brown very strongly. And at the end of the day, even if that does not become a campaign issue and say Meg Whitman becomes the next governor, will she push for more changes to the pension system for state workers? I mean, let's not forget Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2005 wanted a dramatically different system where you went from a defined benefit, which is a traditional pension, to a defined contribution, which is more like a 401k. Now, he dropped that plan. But I would not be surprised if a Governor Whitman, should she be elected, want to push that again. So I think you're going to see a lot about public employees, pension deals. You're going to hear a lot of that, I think, in this campaign.
John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED News. John, thanks for getting us started this morning.
You're welcome, Dave.
Now to round out our conversation, we're joined by Terry Brennan. He's Senior Government Relations Advocate for the union John just mentioned, SEIU California. That's the Service Employees International Union. It represents some 700,000 public and private sector workers around the state. Terry, good morning.
Good morning.
Daniel J.B. Mitchell joins us, too. He's Professor Emeritus at the Anderson Graduate School of Management and the School of Public Affairs at UCLA. Professor Mitchell, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And Steve Greenhut joins us, too. He's the author of a new book called Plunder, How Public Employee Unions Are Raiding Treasuries, Controlling Our Lives, and Bankrupting the Nation. He's also director of the Journalism Center for the Pacific Research Institute, a conservative think tank. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, let's pick up where John Myers left off in terms of setting the stage for this wider debate, which does seem to be one that will be getting a lot of attention in the months ahead. Professor Mitchell, why don't you give us your sense as to whether or not the deals that were being negotiated in Sacramento this week, the situation in the city of San Jose that I alluded to with the city budget being passed last night requiring a 10% cut for city workers, whether these are all pretty strong signals, pretty much signs of the times in terms of what public employees can expect in the future?
Well, if we go out into the distant future, I'm not sure. But right now, the public sector is short of funds, as John Myers said, and there isn't a lot of money to go around, whether it's for pensions or just straight pay or any other kind of benefit. And so I think you're going to see deals along the lines that the governor negotiated more widely. There are these political pressures, too. As noted, Meg Whitman is probably not going to be friendly if she's elected to governor to the governorship to the public sector unions or unions more generally. And Jerry Brown, although he's been supported by unions, he is famously mercurial, so exactly what stance he might take if he were elected or reelected governor once in office, that's not so clear either. So I think unions might feel that it's best to negotiate a deal now rather than wait for the uncertainty that's going to come in January.
Terry Brennan, do you agree with that at SEIU, that though times aren't great now, they may get worse, so best to come up with a negotiated settlement right now?
I'm not convinced of that fact. However, I believe it is something that should be discussed at the bargaining table. I mean, if the governor comes to the table in good faith, if he had for the last 3 years, which he hasn't, deals like this might have been struck earlier. Deals involving pay cuts, furloughs, changes to the retirement contributions are happening elsewhere. It's proof that the collective bargaining system works if you actually approach it in that way.
What has to happen for your union, which, as John Myers mentioned, is probably has the most muscle and the largest membership? Is there a desire among your membership to say, listen, we realize the state's in a bad way and we're willing to do our part?
Absolutely. There's a recognition that you know, the state's in real economic trouble. One of the ways to deal with that is come to the table and bargain in good faith. What the governor's done instead is implement furloughs, increase the contribution for these members to their health care system, and not bargain. I think our members would look forward to actually having some sort of agreement that gave them some stability, something to look forward to in the future, and some guarantees. But at this point, they're living under the world of furloughs, even though today was the last day, and threats of minimum wage if they don't come to an agreement, and threats about, you know, pillaging their retirement system. I think that's not the way you come to agreement. That's not the example that was set by these other unions. Whether or not our union would come to the table with the exact same agreement, it's hard to say.
I realize you're not going to stake out your bargaining position here on live radio, but are you saying, though, that from your point of view, from SEIU's point of view, that you would be willing, for example, to up the amount of contribution to pension funds, to consider ways of other kinds of so-called givebacks?
I like I say, I'm not at the bargaining table. I am not one of the people who's talking about this. But anybody who believes that there aren't concessions needed in this world is, you know, in some sort of fantasy land. But you have to think of retirement in the total compensation. It means people have foregone pay raises for a long time. There are no cost of living increases. There are no, you know, there have been increases to their contribution to health care. There have been gives along this way. The question is, are you going to do it in agreement with the employees as part of an agreement, or are you going to try and force it on them, which has been the governor's approach thus far?
Terry Brennan, Senior Government Relations Advocate for SEIU. That's the Service Employees International Union. Steve Greenhut joins us, too. He's at the Pacific Research Institute and wrote a book with a pretty provocative title, Steve, Plunder, How Public Employee Unions are Raiding Treasuries, Controlling Our Lives, and Bankrupting the Nation. What's your take on what's going on right now? I guess, in a way, I want to get your view of what's happening culturally, in a sense. I mean, is it your view that the time is really ripe to make big changes and that public employees are going to get what they're due?
Well, yeah, this is the time. If it's not going to happen now, I mean, if you look at things like the Pension Tsunami website, a news aggregator for all the news stories of pension-related deals, and there are tons of them on there now. Everyone's talking about it, and it's not just people on the – I'm a libertarian. It's not just libertarians and conservatives talking about it. I'm reading Sacramento Bee editorials where, you know, I looked at yesterday's where they talk about how Democratic legislators are obfuscating, waiting for union bosses to tell them when and how they can act. I mean, it's not, people are recognizing the power of the unions and how they've been able to really plunder treasuries. And I was a longtime columnist at the Orange County Register, where I covered these sorts of pension deals in local government. And I've watched the unions and the power they bring, especially at local government. And it's not just Democrats, by the way. I was reporting in a conservative county, in a Republican county. And when it comes to law enforcement unions and firefighters, you know, who in Orange County earn an average of $175,000 a year in pay and benefit package. So, you know, we've seen that the public is start. There's definitely a sea change. There's no question about it. In fact, I hear from public employees who tell me that it's gone too far. I was talking to a Democratic legislator the other day who, of course, off the record, and of course he won't support anything publicly, but he recognizes that it's gone too far. And the idea that this can all be handled at the negotiating table, which is the SEIU line now, and it's when the Senate rejected SB 919, which would have created a new second-tier pension, that's what the Democratic legislators said. Oh, this could be handled at the negotiating table. What's at the negotiating table that we got the problem that we're in right now? And the idea that these unions, and I've watched them just destroy candidates who support any sort of modest pension reform, and this deal that's been cut is a very, very, very modest deal. If anything more serious, they're going to come at you. So, but the public seems to be getting that.
Let's dig into the nature of the problem. And this is tricky terrain, and you can spin numbers in a variety of ways. But Professor Mitchell, UCLA, give us some sense of what the situation is with the public employee union retirement and pension benefits in this state. Are they really so outlandish? You read stories about the number of public employees that can retire at $100,000 or more. But give us some context for all of those numbers. Are they really that out of line? How do they compare to other states? So forth.
Well, first of all, there are different ways in which pension finance and pension actuaries sort of look at these sorts of issues. And I think you have to put the pension issue in a larger context, particularly here in California. Since I'll date it roughly around 1990, we have had what's called a structural deficit at the state level. Which means that basically we end up chronically borrowing to meet operating expenses. And in a way, making pension promises that are underfunded is, you know, another way of sort of borrowing to meet ongoing expenses. And that's considered bad fiscal policy at the state and local level to be doing that. So the pension issue is part of this sort of larger issue that the state needs to straighten out so that we pay for ongoing expenses with ongoing revenues. What pension actuaries will say is that we have a concept called the normal cost of a pension. We're talking about these defined benefit pensions where it's based on your age and your service and your earnings history and that sort of thing. And what they will say is what you ought to do is calculate each year what the value of the promise that you are making in that year, that's accruing that year, that's the contribution you ought to be making into the fund, the normal cost.
And by
and
those
if you do
standards,
that money will be there when those people retire, and it's just part of their earnings package, whether you're paying them in cash or pension or health care or whatever else.
And by those standards, are California public employees putting enough into their pensions, or is that percentage, has that percentage been lowballed in the past?
Well, we haven't put enough in, and that's why there is an underfunded pension system. It varies, you know, up and down with the stock market, and obviously the big collapse in the stock market, particularly in 2008, aggravated the situation dramatically. But the pension funds, on a kind of an ongoing, long-term basis, in many jurisdictions, were underfunded. And again, it's part of this notion that if you don't meet your operating expenses with ongoing revenues, eventually down the road, you're in trouble.
And I want to get Terry Brennan's view on this in a moment. But one more question, Professor Mitchell, which is, are the average pensions for public employees, and I know averages are tricky because it depends on when people retired or whether they worked 10 years versus 30 years and so forth and so on. But on average, do California public employees get fatter pension deals than their counterparts around the country?
I really don't know the answer to that. I think it's quite varied depending on, you know, what jurisdiction you're in and what occupation you're in. Some pension plans in California have had abusive elements like pension spiking. Pension spiking means that effectively in the whatever earnings period is used for calculating what your monthly pension is, you throw in things like overtime and sort of not things that go beyond your sort of the basic salary. Those are the kinds of things that really need correction.
Terry Brennan, weigh in on this. Well, put in context from your point of view how those pension benefits compare to your counterparts in other states.
First of all, let me completely agree with the professor that pension spiking is one of the nastiest abuses approaching us now. Most of these quote-unquote excessive pensions being talked about in the newspaper are the result of people in a position of management able to manipulate their compensation and inflate it beyond what's deserved. That's why we're supporting two pieces of legislation through the legislature right now that would eliminate that pension spiking and eliminate the ability for highly placed management folks to manipulate their retirement benefit. It's not overtime that's the issue. It's the ability to manipulate car allowances, housing allowances, all sorts of other assorted pay that's not paid in cash that becomes something they calculate for your retirement that's really driving some of these excessive numbers you see. Let me talk a little bit about context.
And I'm sorry to jump back in. Yeah, sure. Sorry to jump back in on you, but we just have a minute before going to our break.
Sure.
So give us what you can on that, and then Steve Greenhut will come back to you after the break.
$100,000 pensions is less than 1% of all the retirees. The average retiree for the state last year, not including everyone else, earned $2,195 a month after working 20.1 years, and that includes everybody, cops, miscellaneous, safety, highway patrol, school employees, and the public agencies. The average PERS retiree made $2,195 a month.
So about $25,000 a year. Yeah.
Right. 80% of all the retirees make less than $30,000 a year. Okay? If that's excessive, you know, I'm having trouble figuring it out. If that's, you know, it's $2,000 above what's the minimum, you know, required to live comfortably in California, according to the budget project. So after more than 20 years of public service, to retire on less than $30,000 a year, I don't think is an excessive pension deal.
That's Terry Brennan. He's with the Service Employees International Union. When we come back, we'll get Steve Greenhut's view on that. He has a different take on pension benefits and on the role of public employees. We'll hear from Steve, the rest of our guests, when we return. And we also want to hear from you. This is a subject that's going to get increasing attention in the months ahead. What do you think about the state of public employees? If you are a public employee, what's your thoughts on whether or not your unions have to do more to contribute, or whether or not you feel like you're being unfairly blamed for the overall state budget situation? Here's the number if you'd like to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Go to our website, kqed.org/forum, if you want to add a comment there, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the state of public employees and their unions. So much in the crosshairs these days of both public scrutiny and political debate. We want to get your thoughts on this subject. Do you think public employees are being unfairly pointed at these days? Or is it time for public employees to step forward and help do their part to solve the budget crisis that is before us? Here's the number if you want to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786. And you can email us as well at forum@kqed.org. Steve Greenhut, why don't you weigh in next on this subject? Steve is at the Journalism Center, directs the Journalism Center for the Pacific Research Institute. You heard Terry Brennan before the break say that the average retiree from the state gets about $25,000 a year. And that doesn't seem like an excessive amount. We all know what it cost to live in this state for someone who has given 20 years of service to the state. A $25,000 a year retirement doesn't sound excessive. What's your view?
Well, come on. You know how averages work. It's still almost 2 to 3 times what the private sector retiree gets. But the idea, these $100,000, the averages include everything, okay? So they go back 30 years, and most of the pension increases, the dramatic ones, have happened in the last 10 years. And actually, the averages for those who are retiring in the last few years is much higher. The $100,000 pension club, for instance, is increasing about 40% a year. And, you know, as I said, it's still 2 to 3 times what the private sector gets. And formulas are formulas. If you are a police or fireman, and the rank and file, police, fire, prison guards, other public safety, are filling the ranks, it's not just management. If you start working at 20 and you work and you retire, you can retire at 50 with 90% of your final year's pay, period. And that's what's happening. Plus, there are all sorts of other ways to spike those pensions. And it's nice that the SEIU all of a sudden is starting to show some flexibility on even dealing with some of the most absurd pension spiking schemes and the idea that we could, in California, the only state that allows its employees to base their retirement on the final year's pay. So it's nice, but that's another sign of the shift, that the unions are willing to tweak things around the edges, deal with the most egregious abuses, because the public is starting to get fed up by the bigger picture, which is the fact that the public employees are retiring with much, much higher pensions than the average private sector employee. And you just have to look. I mean, I have a 401k plan that's typical in private sector. Compare that to the defined benefit plans that public employees get, and it's much more generous in the public sector. That's not even no question. But the new argument, another argument that's coming up that's really interesting, and it's one that David Crane, the chief pension advisor to Governor Schwarzenegger, made, is the utter depletion of public services. When he was completely ignored by the Democrats when he was here at a hearing on pension reform. But he said one cannot both be a progressive and be opposed to pension reform. The math is irrefutable that the losers from excessive and unfunded pensions are precisely the programs progressive Democrats tend to applaud. Those programs are being driven out of existence by rising pension costs.
Well, to give this some numbers, what you're referring to is the fact that about 7%, as I understand it, of the state budget goes to pension obligations. That's $6 billion a year, which is more than some of the social programs that you're referring to. But I want to get Terry.
At the local level, it really is depleting services. And that's the argument, I think, that's being made on the left. And that's part of this whole, I think, sea change. That my point is just, it's not just a dollar and cents issue. It's an issue of what is this doing to the different programs?
And what is it that we want to use our dollars for?
Absolutely.
But Terry Brennan, why don't you get in a response? And then we've got lots of people who want to join the conversation. So a brief response, Terry, and then we'll get to our callers.
Yes, it's a little disingenuous to suggest that the public pension costs are driving away services. The entire contribution by the state to PERS pension costs this year are $3.5 billion. Out of a $20 billion deficit and out of a $100 billion budget, it's less than 4% of the entire cost. I don't think that's driving away services. It's part of the compensation package. Yes, it's gone up, but it's gone up from a period when the state was paying zero for several years. Had the state paid during that period and local agencies when the employers took pension holidays, we would not be having this conversation today.
In your view on the averages question, it is true that averages are – you can play them lots of different ways. And the point that Mr. Greenhut is making is that if you look at the most recent retirees when benefits have gone up, and for people who do put in, you know, 30 years, they can retire at 90% of their pay, which is indeed higher than you're going to find really anywhere in the private sector. Frame that differently if you would.
Okay. First of all, to correct the record, that number I gave you was last year's, the retirees of June 30, 2009. That did not average in everybody who retired any decade, any year, any time before. That was the average pay for a retiree from the state, including the safety officers who retired allegedly at 90% of pay. The fact is, most of them, their average entry age is later in life in service. The average age of retirement was near 60 years of age for all the retirees. For the safety of the Highway Patrol, it was still age 55. So to suggest that people are retiring at age 50 on 90% of pay, despite what the formula may allow, mm-hmm. is not correct.
Yep.
There's no evidence.
Let's hear from our listeners. Daniel wants to weigh in first from Lafayette. Daniel, go ahead.
Is this me?
Yes, you're on.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you. So I am a state employee. I'm a civil engineer, and I work for the state. I live in the Bay Area. Part of the trade, and I think something that's not getting much play here in the conversation, part of the trade-off that I made in accepting the pension is that my salary over the last 25 or so years has largely lagged by 30 or so percent. Over, that is to say, salary and other benefits has lagged by 30 or so percent over what a civil engineer would make in the private sector in the Bay Area. And I'm wondering, first of all, you know, that obviously strikes me as any of these discussions where people want to nail my pension seem to be grossly
yep.
unfair. But also, that's going to make it exceedingly difficult for me to recruit new engineers to come to work for the state. When they're paid crummy wages and their benefits
yeah.
look like nothing better than they can get in the private sector.
Daniel, thanks. It's an interesting point, and it is the classic argument that's made, Professor Mitchell, about the trade-off, that the idea is public employees take a somewhat lower salary than they might be able to get in the public in the private sector, but in return, they have a degree of job security and they have these pension benefits. Is that deal coming up? Part, do you think?
Well, I think it's very important, as your listener says, that you look at total compensation, not just any particular component of compensation. And so, to the extent that that he was being, if you like, underpaid in salary, and then compensated through the pension promise, that's an important element of his willingness to work for the state, or anybody's willingness to work for the state or not. So it's very important for recruitment and retention to look at it in the total compensation area. Now, if, on the other hand, we make him pension promises and then don't fund them in that normal cost way that I had discussed earlier, then, in effect, we are using his services today and asking people at some later date who won't be enjoying those services to pay for them, plus whatever services, public services, they want to have down the road. So, again, we don't want to underfund the pension, even if total compensation is in benefit plus salary is matching the private sector.
Daniel Mitchell, Professor Emeritus at UCLA. Let's hear from Rebecca next, who joins us in San Francisco. Rebecca, go ahead.
Hi. My question is about seniority. I am a city employee in San Francisco, and as we are facing layoffs this year, it's not based on anything besides the date that you were hired. So it doesn't matter if you come in and work hard all day long and do a good job, or if you come in and are cranky and sleep in your truck all day. And I'm curious what your guests have to say about the effectiveness of city employees within the seniority system.
Rebecca, thanks. Terry Brennan.
Well, I'm not an expert on contract law or the seniority system, but seniority is built into most contracts to protect against the ability of managers to lay off people before they're eligible for retirement and for benefits, and the ability of management to arbitrarily assign who stays and who goes. I'm sorry that affects you personally, but I'm not an expert on the seniority process or civil service.
This is, though, culturally, I guess you would say, Terry Brandon, one of the things that, you know, when people read stories, it's not only these stories about perhaps these very high pension benefits, but it is concern about productivity, or it is with the teacher union, the question of whether or not bad teachers are protected by tenure and by their unions. It's those sorts of questions in this time where people feel stressed, where people feel insecure about their futures, where the economy is so volatile. It's those kinds of things, don't you think, that are bothering people as well?
Well, I think it is those stories that are bothering people. How much of that reality is there, you know, is a question. You know, everybody's insecure. This economy, you know, there have been 1.2 million jobs lost. There have been almost a million foreclosures, and 2 million Californians have lost their health care. Do you think people have a right to have some insecurity and unstableness? Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why you see unions willing to go to the bargaining table and talk about real solutions about solving budgets. We've told employers locally, if you're willing to come to the table and talk about solutions to your budget, ways to deal with the deficits, we're a willing partner. If you come with a political agenda, much like the Reason Foundation's, you're not going to have a partner. And that's why you've seen it work in those places where, and when I say it work, agreements between the employers and the employees, where they've had a common interest in solving the budget problem rather than a political agenda.
Let me read some of the things that are coming in on our website and through email that our listeners are feeling and saying about this topic. Benjamin writes, here in Healdsburg, a town of 12,000, the fire and police chiefs both retired. Each of their pay with benefits was $275,000 per year, and when they retired, they basically kept this salary and their benefit packages. Peter writes in, the same folks who would have us believe that $25,000 a year in retirement is excessive are the same ones stripping benefits and wages from private sector employees as well. It's an unsustainable philosophical position which will leave us all broke and enslaved. Another listener writes in, make a distinction, please, between local and state employees. As a state employee, I assure you the rank and file at the state are not getting spiked benefits or even competitive salaries. We stay at our jobs because the benefits have been pretty good in the past. Peter writes in, interesting program today. One single comment. I know a man who was employed for a long time by the state in Sacramento who is now retired on full salary. How is this possible? So lots of people weighing in on this subject. Steve Greenhut, quick thought from you on what you're hearing, and then I want to get to more of our listener calls.
Okay, it's by no means clear that public employees earn less than their counterparts. There are a variety of studies. A number of them show they actually earn more. There's one that came out recently that showed they have earned a little less. But the fact is, it's not clear. They're not getting 30% less. And in public safety jobs, especially firefighters, they're, you know, lines around the block. They had to open a stadium once in Orange County for all the applicants. So that's not clear at all. But the idea that SEIU has no political agenda and they just want to go negotiate at the table, it's crazy. Their idea is to raise taxes to sustain these programs, you know, to sustain these kind of level of pay.
Well, I don't think Terry Brandon was saying they don't have a political agenda.
Yeah,
he was saying the other people who are entering into this come at the negotiations with one as well.
Political agendas, and but there's a problem here. We're not, you know, we have a real unfunded liability that's a real debt. It's a senior debt. It has to be paid, and we're not talking about the gentleman who called and made a point about. Okay, let's say it's true and he did earn less and he got a promised level of benefit. Well, nobody's talking about taking away his pension benefit. We're talking about creating a new tier for new hires. And if that, you know, and the market will see. We'll see if we get enough applicants under the new tier. My sense is these new tiers proposed are still extremely generous, far, far more generous than most people get in the private sector. So I don't think there'll be a problem hiring.
Let's hear from more of our listeners. Daniel in Santa Rosa wants to weigh in on this topic. Daniel, go ahead, please.
Yeah, a couple of quick points. One is I think a lot of folks don't realize what public workers, including state workers, actually do. I'm a union rep with SEIU. The folks I represent take care of disabled vets, take care of developmentally disabled people, and teach blind children. They're not all bureaucrats. Most of them are actually doing really important things that give us a better society. And rather than quibbling over the remaining crumbs from a shrinking pie, I think we should be looking at why the pie is shrinking. If folks in the private sector don't have adequate pension, maybe that's the problem, not the folks in the public sector. If we look at most other industrialized democracies, they have much better plans and benefits than our public sector workers. The average worker that we represent makes $32,000 a year. That's not exorbitant.
Daniel,
and a lot of the folks I represent, the janitors, the secretaries, the cooks, after the furloughs, they take home $1,500 a month. Most of them can't live on that. They have second jobs. No one's getting fat off this. The problem is that we have shifted from a society that says we need to pay people a living wage because that's what makes a livable society to this sort of rampant greed thing where we pay people on Wall Street $1 billion a year, but we won't pay a teacher or a janitor or a cook enough to feed their children.
Daniel, I'm going to hold you there, but thanks. Thanks for adding in your point of view and reminding us of the work, important work, that the public employees do around the state. No one, I think, should doubt that or forget that as well. So, Daniel, thanks for adding that in. John wants to be next in Berkeley. John, go ahead.
Hello?
Yep, you're on the air.
Yeah, I find this whole argument, while it reflects the current circumstances in California, it's really tragic. We're pointing to some of the excesses that exist, like members that exist in any system for pension or where there's money involved. But we're not really emphasizing, I think a point needs to be remembered, is how we got here, the fact that the pension fund managers were investing largely in credit default swaps, CDOs, these fixed income insurance plans, which were scams, as we've had the biggest transfer of public money into private hands in the history of mankind, and our local governments are stuck with the red tape, the red on their budgets, because they have to guarantee these funds. So I think any discussion about how we're going to fix the system can't just be about pointing fingers and creating social distrust of who's getting too much, but it needs to reassess how we invest our money for people that are in these pension plans so we don't end up here again, and also hold the people that got us here by investing this money in terrible ways accountable.
John, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Professor Mitchell, UCLA, just respond briefly, if you would, please, on that point. CalPERS, in the past, that account did very well until the stock market crash and everyone sort of went down. But how would you respond to that criticism about the way in which pension funds are managed?
Well, you could run a pension fund in a very conservative way and just invest the money in treasury bills and so on. You'd get a very low return, and you'd have to make very large contributions into it. So the fact is that pension managers look for higher return types of investment as part of their portfolio management. Beyond that, I would simply say that although CalPERS did very well in the boom period, there's still this issue that if you don't put in the normal cost year after year after year, whether you're doing well in a particular year or poorly in a particular year, you can end up ultimately, even if you seem to do well in the market, with an underfunded pension plan. I think that's kind of the lesson, the financial lesson that can be drawn from this.
A number of people are writing in and wanting to know about this sort of public versus private comparison, Terry Brennan. The figures that I looked up show that the average private pension from a 401k is $11,000. So while you're quite right in saying $25,000 isn't necessarily a lot, it's still 2.5 times the average private. And Holden writes in, how do these comparisons work? Private sectors most private people can't get real pension guarantees anymore at all. So respond to that concern, that while it's true what you're saying in terms of how people retired at $25,000 a year last year with 20 years of service, that's still better than a lot of people are finding these days in the private sector.
Well, first of all, let me just state that that caller from Berkeley was absolutely correct. The real issue here is what happened to the stock market. In terms of funding these pension systems, the agencies, the employers, and CalPERS relied on 75% of every dollar in benefit coming from stock market returns. That may or may not be something we can rely on in the future, but the fact that we had a meltdown in the market is why we're having this conversation. It wasn't an underfunding. They were funding based on the historical average of 7.9% return over the last 30 years.
But you wouldn't
that
disagree.
That may not be the case
right.
in the next
You wouldn't
years.
Disagree that we are facing a big unfunded liability.
Correct.
And those contributions
Absolutely.
Have to increase. But speak to my question, if you would, please,
okay.
about the fact that every public employee.
The question here?
Yeah.
Yeah, the fact that most employers have abandoned secure pensions in favor of a 401k plan. We're going to have the first generation of retirees come of retirement age who have nothing but a 401k and Social Security. And what the research is showing us is nobody can afford to retire. I don't think we want a situation in the United States where nobody can afford to retire because we've abandoned secure retirement.
So, in other words, just because the bar has been lowered on the private side doesn't necessarily mean we ought to do the
absolutely.
Same.
Absolutely, yeah. And the fact that it is part of total compensation.
Steve's,
you get paid less in pay and in exchange for more secure retirement, and that is a fact by every study you've seen.
Steve Greenhut.
Terry's going pretty easy on CalPERS and some of their investments, including some of these leveraged investments at the height of the real estate market. And one of the reasons they had to take such aggressive investment is because of the retroactive pension increases that are granted that change midstream, change the amount of money that have to be brought back in. I saw it when I was covering Orange County politics. I watched Republicans, by the way, retroactively increase pensions twice, and that changed everything, and it created instant unfunded liabilities. And the Gerard Miller with Governing Magazine says there's no ever, never, ever any reason to retroactively increase pensions. It's just a gift of public funds and a buy-off for to labor union negotiators.
I want to read a few more emails and then pose a last question for all of you. Chris writes in, as an engineer, it took me less than 5 years in the private sector to surpass my father's civil servant engineering income, but he made that trade-off for a stable retirement. Mark writes in, the state employee neglected to mention the fact that he does not have any unemployment periods. When you average this, you'll find that his 30% less is more than the private employee who has to deal with periods of unemployment, though I guess you could say furloughs are a way of counteracting that. Rachel writes in, I'm disgusted with the panel's clear bias against unions or panelists. I think that's you, Steve. A clear bias against unions and working Californians. I'm a private sector employee, not a member of any union, but I have no problem with these SEIU members getting the money that they justly deserve. And Carrie writes in, this debate, while important and necessary, only serves to divert our attention from the debate we should be having over, guess what, Proposition 13. All right, well, we'll have to come back to that another time. I want to read a quote I found in an article by Mickey Koss, the LA Times a blogger and magazine blogger who also blogs for the magazine Slate. And get your reactions to it just as a last way of kind of wrapping this up. Here's the quote. The deal used to be that civil servants were paid less than private sector workers in exchange for an understanding that they had job security for life. But we politicians, pushed by our friends in labor, gradually expanded pay and benefits while keeping the job protections and layering on incredibly generous retirement packages. Talking about this is unpopular, but at some point, someone is going to have to be honest about those facts. That's from Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, former speaker, of course, and someone who has largely championed unions in the past. But I guess I wanted to read it because it shows that a lot of people now are thinking about this issue. So go around on that once, what you think we ought to be thinking about, because this topic is going to be front and center in the public debate over the next 5 months. Just 30 seconds each on that. Professor Mitchell first.
Yes, well, I think this is part of the initial question whether there has been a change in attitude and why you're getting some of these concession deals now, given the fact that folks like Willie Brown and others are making those kinds of statements, suggests to union negotiators that it'd be better to work out a deal before we get to a new governor and a whole new legislature and so on than to wait and see what happens.
Steve Greenhut.
Yeah, people on the left are starting to see it. It's not just the percentage of the state budget that goes to service pensions, but at the local level, it's incredible. In Vallejo, which went bankrupt because of these excessive pay and benefit packages, they've had to slash police services, fire services. I've had allies on the left fighting these pension spiking deals in Orange County because of what it means for services. In the city of San Diego, 70% of its payroll budget goes to retirees in the form of pensions and health care. So something has to shift. People on the left are going to have to start seeing this. This is a left-of-center state, and people, this has a broad bipartisan appeal potentially, and that's what I think we're seeing. People like Willie Brown, even Bill Lockyer has warned about the pension system.
And Terry Brennan, last representing the Service Employees International Union. Terry?
Really, Steve? Allies on the left in Orange County? That's about as mythical as the premise of your book. The fact here is people are still behind the public employees. You see the polling. California teachers, nurses, firefighters do a good job for the public and deserve to be paid accordingly. The fact that we may have over-relied on investment returns and the tank in the market has created a huge unfunded liability that we will have to reckon with. Don't get me wrong, it's real. Doesn't mean we need to attack the public employees rather than the Wall Street bankers who are responsible.
We'll leave it there. Steve Greenhut joining us this hour along with Professor Daniel Mitchell and Terry Brennan. Thanks all very much for being part of our program. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. Our engineer this hour, Paul Langour. And we also want to thank our interns, Ariel Niedermeyer, Nadia Reed, David Mercher, and Elena Kadavny. Thanks for their help in putting together this program as well. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.